We're here now to talk about some research that's happening abroad from the UK. This session is part of a cooperative effort that is being sponsored by the UK Research and Development Organization. So we have several people here who are going to be talking about very important topics in electrochemistry. Our first speaker is Dr. Edward Roberts from the University of Manchester, and he's going to be talking about the techno-economic modeling of a utility-scale redox flow battery system.
Thanks very much. I'll try and stay by the lectern. I may have a tendency to wander around, but I know this is the only microphone I've got. So it's a great pleasure to be here over here in the US. I'm from Manchester in the UK. That's the real Manchester, obviously. If you're ever over in the UK, you're very welcome to come to Manchester. Just remember to bring your umbrella. How do I do this? Green button. I'm an academic who likes to think about money as well as technical problems. So I'm going to talk about some economic analysis of flow battery systems. I think I'm giving the first flow battery talk, but there's quite a few coming, so I suspect we'll see slides a little bit like this one again. I'm sure most of you are familiar with the idea of a flow battery, where we store our chemical energy as liquids, as dissolved redox species, so that the real advantage of doing that is that we get some economies of scale when we go to large energy storage systems, so that we can scale up the storage capacity just simply by having very large tanks. And we flow our electrolytes through our battery cells where we get the power out. So the power is related to the area of electrode, and the capacity, or the amount of energy you store, the kilowatt hours, is related to the size of the tanks that you've got. This slide shows the system for the polysulfide bromine system. This is my first time at ESA, and I don't know whether this system was presented in the past, but this technology was developed in the UK and until about 2003. There was a lot of activity on polysulfide bromine. And I don't know if you've seen this before, but this system was being developed at a pretty large scale. This was a 15-megawatt, 120-megawatt-hour storage plant flow battery system being developed by... Well, it started out National Power, then became Innogy, and finally RWE. And this plant was being built in 2003 with 100-cell bipolar stacks. I can't remember how many of these stacks you needed to get your 15 megawatts, but I guess it's about 100 or so. And during the process of commissioning, it was RWE pulled the plug and the process was shut down. I'm not going to talk about that history. But that's where the work comes from. So we wanted to do some techno-economic modelling of the value or the costs associated storing energy at this sort of scale using redox flow battery technology and using the polysulfide bromine system as an example of a flow battery system. So the question we were trying to answer, or what I was interested in doing, was trying to link the technical parameters of the flow battery with the economic performance. So, for example, how does the operating conditions, for example, the current density, affect the economics of the flow battery? And how do some of the other technical parameters, like the electrochemical kinetics, the selection of the redox couple, affect the costs of the system? So we built a fairly simple, in academic terms, fairly simple model of the polysulfide bromine redox flow battery system. We made some assumptions that we assumed that the system was 100% current efficient, so we got 100% charge efficiency, and we simplified the chemistry a great deal. The chemistry is a little bit complicated in this system, but we treated it as if we had bromide and dissolved bromine, and sulfur and sulfide systems. The cell potential was simply calculated as the equilibrium potentials, the losses at each side of the system, plus the ohmic losses. And this, the complicated bit is in these overpotentials of the electrodes. So those of you who are interested in electrochemistry, the overpotentials were calculated based on a modified Butler-Volmer equation accounting for the effects of mass transfer. So if you're not interested in electrochemistry, what we're talking about is when you draw current from an electrochemical system, you have to put some extra voltage in there, right, basically, to drive the current through. So this is an equation that allows you to calculate or estimate the size of that loss at different current densities. The mass transport effects are that when you draw current, because you have to diffuse your reactant to the electrode surface, you will have a lower concentration of active species at the electrode surface. So at the electrode surface, what you see is a different state of charge. And that leads to additional losses, essentially. So we have a very simple, well, complicated equation, but it's a single equation that allows us to relate the current density to the losses in the system. And if we're going to estimate the costs, that's obviously what we need to do. Life gets a little bit more complicated. Whoops. When you have a flow cell, because if you imagine the electrolytes, so this is a very simplified diagram of a flow cell with a membrane, two electrodes, and we flow up this cell, and at the feed end, you have high concentrations of your reactant species, and as you flow through along the electrodes, the concentrations fall, and so you get variations in the current density up the height of the cell. So to describe that, what we wanted to do was be able to draw a total current from the cell, but we had to start by guessing a potential across the cell, dividing the electrode up to a number of segments, and calculating the current density at all of those segments, and then adjusting the cell potential until we got the desired current, applied current for the stack. So we had a slightly complicated model to describe or to relate the cell voltage to the applied current for a single cell. And then we made, again, some simplifying assumptions. We assumed that we operated at pseudo-steady state. In other words, at a given point in the operation, we have given concentrations of the species in the tank. We calculate the performance or the cell voltage in each electrode, and we treat that as a steady-state situation. We don't account for the changing concentration in time for that performance in the stack. We assume that we're applying the same current density during charging as in discharging, and we adjust the flow rate to make sure that we don't lose too much energy through mass transport effects. So when you get to... as you deplete the reactants in the tank, you start to run into mass transport limitations. So we keep the flow rate high enough to ensure that we don't get too close to mass transport limitations. And we also calculated the pressure losses in the system, so the pumping cost. In terms of validation, how well does our model work? Well, actually not that well. This is some pilot plant data. And you compared with our modelling data. Apologise the quality of the slide, but so the pilot. I can't get this pointer to work, unfortunately. But the data during the charge and discharge. Well, the voltages are about right, but the change during the charging and during the discharge don't agree that well. And essentially, that's because we've made so many simplifying assumptions in our model. But the important point is that we do get the efficiency of the system about right. So our economic model was based on the 15 megawatt, 120 megawatt hour battery system that Innogy had developed. So what we did essentially was determined for a given set of operating conditions how many stacks we needed to deliver this power, and how much electrolyte we needed to deliver that much capacity. We assumed an 8-hour charge, an 8-hour discharge, fairly arbitrarily, I should say. And I'm afraid our economics is a little bit out of date now. It's based on 2006 UK prices. The capital cost was estimated at around £41,000 per 100 kilowatt module. And we used a scale factor of 0.9 to account for some economies of scale. In other words, if you're manufacturing large numbers of cells, you'd save a bit of money. And there's some savings on piping costs if you go into larger scale. Then we've got a bit of cost for electrical equipment, and then the cost of the electrolytes, which in this case were estimated at £550 per metre cubed of our bromide electrolyte and about £150 per metre cubed of our sulfur electrolyte. And what we wanted to do was look at the whole life cost. So we used a net present value calculation, assuming a 15-year life of the plant with a 2.5% inflation rate and a 10% discount rate. And we calculated the levelized cost per kilowatt hour of energy delivered. One of the things we wanted to look at was, could you make money out of this system? So we looked at some data from the electricity market in the UK, some spot prices, and those we were looking at charging up at around 2.3 pence per kilowatt hour and discharging or delivering, selling our power with a margin at 5.7 pence per kilowatt hour. Probably quite generous assumption that we could be able to achieve that over 8-hour charge and discharge cycles. So this is the key bit of the finding, which allows us to break down the costs in the system at different operating conditions. So this is the cost in pence per kilowatt hour of the delivered energy, and these are the various components that make up that cost. So what you see is that as you increase the current density, the number of modules you need goes down, so you save the capital cost. There's a little bit of an electrical plant cost that starts to go up when you operate less efficiently. In other words, you've got to put in more power during the charge cycle. The electrolyte cost for this system, one of the reasons that Innergy wanted to develop it, was that the electrolytes were relatively cheap. So the electrolyte cost is quite a small proportion of the cost, but it does rise as you increase the current density. Then we've got above that, the point has gone completely, the cost of the energy you actually deliver and the cost of the losses. So I've split those out, and you see that the main trade-off is reducing the number of modules you need, so reducing the capital cost, while as you increase current density, the cost of the wasted lost energy, or the cost of inefficiency essentially, goes up. And at the top end, we see that the pumping cost starts to rise at high current density because we have to flow our electrolytes faster to avoid getting to mass transport limits. And we get an optimum of about 500 amps per metre squared, 50 milliamps per centimetre squared, which turns out is about the current density that Innergy were operating their plant. Could you make money out of it? Well, for those set of conditions, the bottom line is the profit that you'd make, which was negative, so not surprisingly, you couldn't make money out of this system just by load levelling under those conditions. And what we wanted to do was see how sensitive was this behaviour as we changed the electrochemical kinetics, just the rate constant for the electrochemical reaction. And in order to move this up the half a pence from the half a pence sort of loss point to break even was required about an order of magnitude increase in the kinetics, which is probably achievable. But that's assuming that you don't need... that it doesn't cost you any more to do that, so you don't have to pay for any expensive catalyst. We also looked at what would happen if you had a higher cell voltage, again at no extra cost, which is probably not very realistic. But the polysulfide bromine, here's the sulfur couple and the bromine couple, so you're getting about 1.5 volts in principle. You'd have to increase that quite a lot, over 2 volts to be able to make this system profitable by that route, and that's unlikely to happen since it would almost certainly mean that you're working with a different couple, you're going to have more expensive electrolytes. If you look at the costs, about a 25% reduction in the costs would deliver you a profitable plant. And the electricity price differential, we have this 2.3 to 5.7 margin. If that was 2 pence and sixpence, then you can make money. So obviously it's going to be sensitive to the market environment. So just to sum up, I think for utility scale storage, although the message is that, you know, under those conditions you couldn't make money out of it, I think that if you're working on flow battery development, if you can bring the costs of the system down, and the opportunity to do that is to intensify the technology. What we need to do is get the current density up so that the amount of electrode area we need goes down, and then you can make the technology profitable. And you might do that by improving the kinetics, for example, or improving the design of the system. It might be achievable with changing the standard potential, but I don't think that's very realistic. And, of course, the market environment could also drive this to a profitable system. What I'd really like to do is to extend this to look at different systems. No one's currently commercialising the polysulfide bromine system, but there are a whole array of other systems being commercialised. It'd be very interesting to use this type of modelling to compare the overall economic performance of those different systems. Last thing I'd like to say is that I've noticed through the session so far that the first speaker never gets any questions. So if you've got any questions for me, just make a note of it so that you remember it when we get to the end of the session.
Berlui from the University of Strathclyde, and he's here to talk about substrates for the positive electrode reaction in the zinc-cerium redox flow battery.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm absolutely delighted to be here in San Diego to give you an insight about the work we've been doing at the University of Strathclyde in Glasgow on the zinc-cerium hybrid redox battery system. Right, it's a diagram that you're going to see a lot, so I won't spend too much time on it, but what I want to concentrate is this, the electrode itself, which is a negative electrode, a cation exchange membrane, and the positive electrode. First, what we're going to do, look at all the reactions of the negative, positive, and then bring the whole lot together. And then finally, we're going to take the membrane out. Okay, just for fun. Okay, the zinc-cerium flow redox battery. Why zinc-cerium? Well, zinc, okay, if you look at thermodynamic tables, minus 0.764, cerium 1.44. Therefore, these add up to a glorious 2.2 volts open circuit voltage. What's even more interesting, that if you complex this in nitric or hydrochloric, or even better, methane sulfonic acid, which is this beastie here, you can get the open circuit potential to go as high as 2.45 volts, which is why we use it. Now, we have two electrolytes, one is zinc, and the other side should be pure cerium. But because we have a membrane in between, pure zinc and pure cerium on the other side, you'll get losses due to diffusion. So the zinc electrolyte also contains some cerium, low concentration, and likewise, the cerium also contains some zinc to prevent the back diffusion. Okay. Right. So if you look first at the negative half-cell reaction, what we have, we use a rotating disc setup, rotating disc electrode setup. I'm sure many of you are accustomed with that, by the electrochemist. And we looked at the effect of different zinc concentrations, different temperatures, different charging times, different composite carbon substrates for the negative electrode. That was quite important, actually. And also, effect of solution flow rate, Reynolds number 100 to 250, not very high, but we didn't need high that. High current density, and also different current densities in the range 25 to 250 milliamps per square centimeter. Okay, so if we've got this typical charge discharge, so this is potential versus time, these are the various cycles. So this is just for the zinc half cell reaction, okay? So we charge, we switch to open circuit, and then we discharge. And we repeat that umpteen times. In this case, see, so when you charge, your charge voltage is about minus 1.6 volts, and go to open circuit, about minus 1.44, all the potentials here are measured against a mercury sulfic reference electrode, so it basically is a zinc 2 plus reversible reaction, and then we discharge. Okay, so what we're looking for here, Coulombic efficiency. Amount of charge you put in there, you should get it back out there. And so, and why is also, and also the thing we looked at were the potentials, the overpotential, which Ted talked about there. This is important because at the end of the day, you want to minimize these two components. It makes ESL a lot lower. So what we're looking at here on the slide is a Coulombic efficiency for a number of different composite carbon electrodes. The PVD is a polyvinylidene difluoride, polyvinyl ester, high-density polyethylene, and then compressed graphite foil, and compared to the ubiquitous glassy carbon electrode. What we see there is the number of cycles. You saw 0 to 10 there, but this was repeated. We do 10 at a time. But effectively, you could get very high mid-90s, 95-96% current efficiency, Coulombic efficiency for these substrates. Others didn't work so well. These guys, we didn't use them further. Now, the other thing you could do is look at the effect of zinc concentration, because, as you know, Fluoridox battery, the more concentrated your solution, the more energy you can store. And indeed, if you look at that, we have pretty good, you know, mid-90s, and going from 1.5 to 2 molar, you get about 4% increase in Coulombic efficiency. Great. And then finally, we looked at, well, not finally, many more things we did, but look at the charging time. So here charging at 50 milliamps, okay, 50 milliamps per square centimeter, different charging times. And we find here that the best is 60, 120, and 300 seconds. We maintain the high Coulombic efficiency, but as you go longer than that, you lose. It drops. And I think the simple reason for that, actually, we could be getting some growth on the surface, and the solution flow, it just got knocked off. Okay, but that's on the rotating disk arrangement, okay? Not for the real flow cell. So all very encouraging. And finally, we looked at the impact of current density on the Coulombic efficiency. And here, as you can see, if you stay above 50 milliamps per square centimeter, your Coulombic efficiency stays well above 90% for that reaction. Below that, doesn't work so well because here you're starting, you discharge at low current density, you're competing against the corrosion of the zinc. After all, you've got to remember, you're trying to plate zinc in about 3 molar acid. Thermodynamics is against you, okay? Only kinetics is helping you there because the zinc actually inhibits slightly the hydrogen evolution reaction. So that was a negative half cell. So very quickly, the positive half cell reaction. What we looked at was a series of platinum, iridium-based and platinum-based electrodes. Why? For these expensive things. We wanted to establish a benchmark. And then when we can find an alternative substrate, we could compare it to what we have here. So this is your typical cyclovoltammogram that you get, you know, cerium-4 reduction, cerium-3 oxidation there. And these are a whole load of samples that we tried. And so the SL samples correspond to just platinum and the BMM samples to platinum iridium alloys. And so we want to look at the kinetics. So what we did therefore, we looked at the Tafel extrapolation method to extract the exchange current density. And here we did that as a function of temperature. And not unexpectedly, as you increase the temperature, the exchange current density would increase, you know, modest increase. But for one of those electrodes, which was a platinum iridium one, 30-70 ratio, we had nearly a 2 orders increase in the magnitude of I0.
Yes.
Okay. And why is that important? Because, as you know, the overpotential is dependent on that. So the higher I0 is, the lower your overpotential. So you win. So that's Tafel extrapolation, though, but it's always good. It's only one technique. What you want to do is actually compare it with other techniques for measuring kinetics. And here we use Tafel linear polarization and impedance spectroscopy. And just compare the data. We should give you the same value, but they're not too bad. I mean, we're pretty happy that we're getting the values more or less right in our measurements, okay? Remember, each time, you know, you basically, the electrode could change because we're talking about, you know, quite positive potentials. Whenever you oxidize or reduce cerium, you're not taking place on the metal. You're taking place on the metal oxide because it's very positive. Okay, so here, just like we did before, as an impact of current density, and as you increase the current density, lo and behold, your over potential increases. You know, that's what you expect from the Tafel equation. And Coulombic efficiency there is 100% because you charge, you discharge, you get it back. Now, this is the impact of flow rate, keeping the exchange current density the same. And we see for this instance, the only one where you really suffer is at a very low rate of mass transport, because here you run into concentration polarization, which means that you're not bringing enough cerium to the surface to get your current to flow. So the system looks for another reaction and drops the potential quite negative. And that was an interesting one there, where you look at the effect of temperature. Big impact. At 298 Kelvin, you're getting pretty serious overpotential losses. But just increase the temperature to 60 degrees, your overpotential losses decrease pretty much, okay? Good effect of temperature there. Right, so that's the two individual reactions. Let's bring it all together. So we looked at the impact of flow velocity, temperature, charge, discharge, current densities, also the carbon substrates that we identified to be the best performing ones. Right, the flow cell, so what we did actually, so we have our carbon electrode here. That was one of the ones we used, was a polyvinylene difluoride and the polyvinyl ester one. So there's your flow field plate to direct the flow right over the electrode. Then we cut on there, no, we cut on there, we put on there our NAF iron 117 cation exchange membrane, then put in the other flow field plate for the platinized titanium electrode, which you can see with my invisible pointer. Okay, and then everything, the electrode goes on, put the back plates on there. And I should mention, just going back, dimensions. So that's a 10 by 10 centimeter electrode. So you've got 100 square centimeter of electrodes there. And put it off, we've got ubiquitous peristaltic pump. And here, pumping the two solutions, the yellow one, if you see the tubing with the yellow one, that's a cerium. The clear one is a zinc. And the two reservoirs, we're having about 500 to 600 milliliters of solution, both sides, and in a water bath, so you could control the temperature. As you can see, we'll see in a minute the impact of temperature on that. So that's the system that we had. And this is basically a picture of the zinc coated after an hour at a current density of 10 milliamps per square centimeter. And the beauty of that is that it's smooth. So no evidence of dendrites on there. Okay, it could have all been washed away. But the thing is, once actually you coat, before you discharge, you just strip out all the solution. But the peristaltic pump, it's easy to do that. Flick a switch and it just draws out the solution so we don't get the corrosion of the zinc. Okay. Right, so that's a profile we have, for example, for the discharge. So you just point here, the open circuit potential, 2.45 volts, discharging at 2 milliamps per square centimeter, tinica, right? But the important thing, we want to look how the thing worked, and really flat profile of about 2.15 volts for the discharge. And then, obviously, full discharge, after the zinc coming out, it collapses. And really, there's no impact for this. Under these conditions, flow didn't have a big part on that. But the important thing was this really flat profile that you get. Now, we looked at that, looking at different charging rates, different electrodes. This one is a polyvinyl ester, looking at voltage efficiency and Coulombic efficiency. Not great, okay, 64, 66%. But remember, the system has not been optimized here. We're not fully charged before we start discharging. So we're talking about state of charge about 30 to 40%. We can get much better values if you fully charge the system first. But we're in a hurry. No, actually, it's research. Okay? So what we do, therefore, change electrode to the polyvinyl iodine difluoride. You can up the voltage efficiency and the current efficiency. It works quite well. And here, again, looking at the impact of flow. So these are the various charges at different flow rates, no big impact, and the discharge voltages always quite pretty flat, actually about 2.1. And put it all in a table, comparing now the polyvinyl ester carbon and as a function of temperature. So what we see is actually the best region is about there for this electrode, for this state of charge. I must emphasize the state of charge, which gives you these low numbers. However, we can get voltage efficiency about 68% and Coulombic efficiency about 58%. Now, we change electrode to the polyvalent leading carbon. Again, similar region, about 40 to 50 degrees seems to be the optimum temperature to work the system. Okay, pause for breath. I've got 1 minute to introduce you to something that we thought we'd give it a bash. Okay, this is, you've got this membrane there. We just thought, we didn't think that. It was a group of Southampton who published about it, you know, the undivided zinc cerium cell. Take the membrane out. And we tested it first in the batch mode. Basically, now you have 0.4 molar cerium, 1.5 molar zinc, no membrane between the two. So the voltage efficiency should be really high. We didn't try to optimize that. What we're interested in was a Coulombic efficiency. Could we get it high? So, in principle, this thing shouldn't work, but it works, okay? So there's your charge. Go to open circuit, about 2.3 volts, fantastic, and there's your discharge. And voltage efficiency, like I said, we kept this thing further apart, but you can just change the voltage efficiency by bringing the electrodes closer. But the Coulombic efficiency here was low, okay, 26%. Nothing's been optimized. And here we go for a charge for 2 hours, and you can see we can up the Coulombic and the voltage efficiency because you've generated more cerium-4 during the charging. So it works pretty well. And so what we did then, look at the effect of temperature. How does temperature affect this undivided zinc cerium cell? Okay, one more slide. So if you just watch the numbers that I changed this, what's going to happen? You have basically 66% voltage, about 32% Coulombic. Go to 40 degrees, you can see you're starting to lose Coulombic efficiency, and go to 60 degrees, it drops down. Voltage efficiency goes up. So what this is showing is actually the kinetics of the cerium 4 is actually increasing a bit too much with temperature for the zinc electrode. So we're losing Coulombic there. But point is, nothing's been optimized yet. And my final slide really gives us the conclusions. And pretty optimistic about the redox flow battery with the membrane, but also on the undivided cell, nothing's been optimized, but there's promise there that something could be done about that as well. Thank you for your attention. Okay.
Thank you, Dr. Berlouis. Our next speaker is Dr. Richard Wills of the University of Southampton. He's speaking about the development of flow batteries from proof of concept to pilot scale. Thank you.
Okay, good afternoon. As the title says, it'll be looking at basically benchtop lab scale to pilot scale and commercialization, but I'll be using the soluble lead as the case study for this. So I want to give a slight overview of the scales for flow batteries and the large-scale electrochemical storage, look at what you need for the design parameters, and as I said, use a soluble lead to run through the scale-up process. So I think I'll ignore the pointer because it doesn't seem to have much success with other people. But in terms of the scales of flow battery development, on the one hand, down at the far left, you've got proof of concept, so rotating disc electrode, bench top, a few millilitres of electrolyte, and you're really looking at electrokinetics and do your two redox couples cycle nicely. Then you start to put it into a flow cell on the bench top, see what sort of efficiencies you can get, and whether the system works in a flow cell environment. Moving on to pilot scale, where you're looking at design optimization of the flow stack and the cells, and all the way up to operational plant, where you're looking at hundreds, if not thousands, of kiloamps, as opposed to sort of the milliamp range down at the proof of concept stage. So, in terms of system design, obviously there's the usual suspects you want nice low costs, long life, safe materials, simple to use. And when we're talking about flow batteries, that's a bit of a misnomer, really, because when you start to go to the large scale, really you're looking at a chemical plant as well as pumping in and out electrons. In terms of performance indicators, obviously, as with normal batteries, you've got current efficiency, state of charge, voltage efficiency, and power efficiency, but also an important metric for flow batteries is the space-time yield, so how many moles of material per cubic metre per hour are you converting, and that takes you from the concept of power and electricity metrics to volumes and weights of active material. And something I missed there, that you need to normalise with state of charge and state of health of the system. So I think there are quite a few flow battery talks throughout the conference, and really there's many types of flow battery, from the fairly typical one. I seem to be losing bits of the slide. So from the classic all vanadium, where all of the active species remain solvated in the electrolyte at all states of charge and discharge, and you get hybrid metal flow batteries where you're depositing a metal at one or more of the electrodes. So we saw the zinc cerium, where you're depositing and stripping zinc at the negative electrode. Then you've got the full metal oxide systems, where you've got the hassle of the phase change at both electrodes. And then more hybrids in terms of mixing in some technologies from the fuel cell industry and looking at metal air systems. So, as I said, I'm going to concentrate on the soluble lead, which is a system we've developed over the last 10 or 12 years at Southampton. Here we're using methane sulfonic acid, and the electrode reactions are similar to your traditional lead-acid battery. However, in methane sulfonic acid, the lead 2 ion is highly soluble in the electrolyte. So during charge, you're depositing metallic lead onto the negative electrode, and lead dioxide at the positive electrode. During discharge, you're then solvating back to the lead 2 plus ion. There are a number of advantages with the system. One being is that you don't need an electrolyte. You don't need a membrane, and you've got one electrolyte. So most other systems, you need two sets of pump networks and a membrane, which increases the complexity of the engineering as well as the costs. So in terms of where does the soluble lead system sit, I think we've gone from sort of the proof of concept, fairly small scale, and at the moment I think the biggest system is a 1.5-2 kilowatt stack of five electrodes each with a 1,000 square centimetre geometric area. So cell cycling, I think on the top left graph, just gives a series of short cycles, then some slightly longer cycles. The top black line is the cell voltage, the red line is the positive electrode, and the blue line is the negative electrode. And something to note is that when you look at the overpotentials associated with charge and discharge, it's the positive electrode, so the lead dioxide, which is the dominant contributor there. Really, in terms of improving voltage efficiency, that's where some work needs to go on. The other interesting anomaly with this system is where we're dealing with a phase change at both electrodes. The lead dioxide doesn't completely strip, so you're left with a lead oxide layer film on the electrode surface, and that leads to a slight voltage trough, which you can see in the charging voltage profile of everything past the first charge cycle, and that slowly increases. But it also, while it makes the voltage efficiency a little bit nicer, it leads to complications in terms of longevity of the system, because you build up a sludgy layer and you can get sloughing of the material into the electrolyte. There's a little power curve, and the peak voltage is around about 1.2, 1.3 volts on discharge. Now if we look at the state of charge, so when we're monitoring the flow batteries, there are quite considerable chemical changes and variation in the electrolyte. So for the soluble lead system, for every mole of lead you take out of the electrolyte, you increase the acidity of the system by 2 moles. So as you see there, I think the far right system is a fairly top of charge, so almost 100% state of charge. So there's very little lead in the electrolyte, but quite a lot of acid. Conversely, down at the other end, you're pretty much fully discharged with 1.5 molar lead and just under 1 mole of methane sulfonic acid. As you'd expect, when you start to deplete lead quite considerably on charging, you start to evolve oxygen and hydrogen, and you can have some quite high overpotentials. But if you stick to, going down to 0.1 molar lead, then the overpotentials aren't too horrific. So you're left with effectively 1.4 mole of lead that you can use from per litre from the electrolyte. Now then, cell balancing. It's all very well to operate single cells, but when you start to go up to stacks, really you need complete uniformity between the individual cells within a stack and individual stacks within a system. So on the top left there, you've got a two-cell stack that's operating very nicely. The stack voltage is at the top, and the individual cell voltages, they are both plotted there, and you can see that they overlap completely perfectly, and the system is in harmony and working nicely. On the bottom right, you've starting to hit cell imbalance, and I think this is a part of a discharge curve, and you can see that cell one is pretty happy, sat at 1.6 volts, actually about 1.7 volts, whereas the second cell is failing, and that's bringing down the whole stack. So what happens when the cell starts to fail? With the soluble lead system, the main problems you have are associated with the phase change at the electrodes. You can get a build-up of one or other of the electrode deposits, and or you can get you can get dendritic lead growths, you can get bypass currents, and so if you look at the bottom left, that's a lead dendrite that's actually growing through the inlet manifold for the cell. However, it's not all completely bad news. With engineering of the cell stack, choice of electromaterials, and electrolyte additives, you can go from what's on the left of the screen to what's on the right, and that's a very nice, smooth lead deposit. And again, just to highlight the importance of additives, two current densities with and without additives. On the left, you've got 50 milliamps per square centimetre. On the right, much higher. If you'd operate that in a flow battery, you'd be pretty happy at 375 milliamps per square centimetre. And you can see the difference between the top electrolyte without additives and the bottom electrolyte with additives. It's much smoother, more compact layers. Then we want to go on to system modelling. Quite a complex system with the lead dioxide in particular, but by looking at the electrode reactions, the mass flow into and out of the reactor, we can put a model together that fairly closely fits the experimental data and even reproduces the voltage trough associated with the lead dioxide electrode. So going through the advantages, mainly there's a cost associated with a simpler cell design and engineering because you're taking out the membrane and half of the plumbing. Also, lead in itself is a fairly cheap metal, very readily recyclable, and there's an established supply chain for lead systems. Challenges, as I think I've mentioned, mainly associated with deposition and stripping repeatedly of metals and metal oxides. So keeping the conductivity of the lead dioxide high, eliminating dendritic growths from the lead side. So I'm almost done. So looking at the development history, it goes back quite a way in terms of various patents and papers mentioning soluble lead chemistry. Most recently, there's Southampton and an ARPA project here in the States. So in conclusions, it's a fairly promising flow system, still at the early stages of development, so pilot scale rather than operational or commercial, but there's plenty of scope for improving the system, and also we're always looking for a little bit of funding to continue work. So acknowledgements, plenty of people to say thank you to, and that's it from me.
Professor Bob Slade of the University of Surrey, and he's going to be talking about the temperature dependence of key performance indicators for aqueous electrochemical capacitors containing nanostructures, bernicite, manganese dioxide.
I'll also tell you a little bit about the background in the UK to research in this area. If you look at the slide, top left is the symbol for the UK's Research Council-funded energy programme. The bottom left is the symbol for the Supergen Energy Storage Consortium. Let me tell you about Supergen. Supergen stands for Sustainable Power Generation. There are 15 national consortia in the UK in this area, most of which have between 6 and 10 universities, and each consortium has a four-year budget of between £5 and £10 million. Let's carry on. Here's my nice green university. On the right is a picture of the UK with the southeast expanded. We're an hour from Heathrow and Gatwick airports, so if you're passing through, don't be afraid to ask to come and see us. So I'll tell you a little bit about my research team. I'll also mention Supergen as we go. I lead a team of 20-plus, quite large in a UK university environment. We're in chemical fuel cells, where we're looking at materials, electrochemistry and devices. We're also in the energy storage area, where we've been working for several years on electrochemical supercapacitors, which is the primary emphasis of what I'll say. Within the consortium, the Supergen consortium, there are two other teams working on lithium air batteries and other replacement lithium ion battery systems. And at Surrey, when we renewed 2 years ago, we started work also on redox flow battery systems. I also lead the National Biological Fuel Cells Consortium, and so I work with a range of different biologists. Now, my team styles itself as energy materials and functional devices, and our key emphases are the generation and storage of electrical power by electrochemical and bioelectrochemical methods. Those two have, between the two of them, what's called the credibility gap. The electrochemical methods giving you high power densities and the bioelectrochemical methods giving you low power densities, but they both have applications. And we're primarily materials and devices rather than at the engineering level. So as an illustration of the way the UK works, EPSRC is our equivalent to the NSF. We're in a couple of consortia under Supergen that I've already mentioned. There's also open applications called the Responsive Mode, and we have grants from that. The TSB, the Technology Strategy Board, that Richard just mentioned, is direct interaction with industry, so a consortium there would typically have one or two universities and one or two industries. We also work under EU and IEA programs. So let's go back to that one. This tells you a little bit about what a Supergen consortium looks like. The one that I'm mentioning here has electrochemists, it has materials chemists, chemical engineers, and also electrical engineers. It goes from the mini-grid, where you've incorporated your devices, right back to the individual devices. Primarily, the emphasis of the Energy Storage Consortium is testing new materials in devices. There is one team looking at lithium-ion batteries. Lithium-air batteries. I'm not going to talk any more about that, other than to say that it all looks hunky-dory. I don't know whether that's a couple of American words. It certainly is in British English. Everything looks fine in that you're producing lithium peroxide in a carbon host, but actually it is the electropolymerization of the solvent that can cause very major problems, and I'm glad I'm not working personally in that area. I'm going to talk about three areas potentially. I can stop at any one of three points, so don't worry, you are going to get away. I'll start talking about supercapacitors. And I'll remind you that super or ultracapacitors have a high power capture and delivery capability, in contrast to batteries, which have a higher energy storage capability. So for your high power over short period, it's your ultracapacitor that's going to win, and for your high energy but slow discharge, it's your battery system that's going to be useful. And that contrasts, of course, directly with fuel cells, which will produce power as long as you connect and the fuel's available. So the primary application of ultracapacitors is arguably for rapid response in hybrid systems. You can make your batteries smaller, make them last longer if you hybridize with a supercapacitor, or you can make your fuel cell system work better if you hybridize with a supercapacitor. One of the oldest conceptual applications of supercapacitors was turning an engine to start a diesel engine, demonstrated in Europe 10 or 20 years ago in Romania, in fact, by Siemens. So the capability is rapid energy storage and recovery, not so much long-term response, but short-term smoothing of fluctuations. For power grids, in regenerative braking, and in energy storage associated with rapidly fluctuating renewable sources. Now, supercapacitors, ultracapacitors, there are so many different types that one can correctly describe this diagram as a taxonomy. It's all the different classifications of supercapacitors. Down the left-hand side, we essentially have systems which are all carbon. Down the right-hand side, we have systems which include a redox species in one or both of the electrodes. And then down the middle, down the red line, we have hybrid supercapacitors where you quite possibly have two different electrodes, either that or you have both a carbon and an oxide in a composite electrode. So there is a wide variety of possibilities. One word in the title may put chills in your spine. Is everything nano these days? There are reasons why one nanostructures, particularly oxide electrodes. One is that that generates a high specific surface area on which electrochemical processes can occur. For the electrochemists, that's your double layer developing. In an oxide electrode, you're also going to get some diffusion into the electrode, not just onto the electrode. And so you want a short diffusion length. That's another reason for nanostructuring. You don't want metals you're not accessing. The high internal surface areas are also important in hierarchically porous systems, normally carbons. So these are all nanostructured systems. The top one, pellicular, means skin-like. That's actually a doped conductive polymer, which is polypyrrol on carbon paper. The veins there, which make it look like a leaf, are the veins, the fibers in toray carbon paper, which is the host. Bottom left, we have some nanofibrous manganese dioxide, and to the right, we have some VO2, vanadium dioxide nanorods. All of these are of interest as supercapacitor electrode materials. However, that's not the whole story. There's a lot of chemical fine control. Depending what you do, for instance, with manganese dioxide, you can end up with any one of a whole range of morphologies reproducibly. A and B, which are, I think, the top two, show one form of manganese dioxide. C is another form of manganese dioxide. D, which is the one in the middle to the right, if my eyes don't deceive me, is what we term actually nano grapes of beta manganese dioxide. And then at the bottom are forms of what's called bernosite, which has a little bit of potassium in it, as well as manganese and oxygen. And you get some very interesting morphologies. This is also a bernosite in what people are tending to call these days nano belts. So it's a parallel array of slightly potassium-doped manganese dioxide ribbons. So in supercapacitors, which is the only topic I'm going to cover looking at the time, we have established methodologies. Here is a lab-scale representation of an established methodology. You prepare a 50 to 100 micron thick electrode using your electrode material, a small amount of graphite to enhance electronic conduction, and a similarly small amount of PVDF or another polymer as binder, and you end up with a thick film electrode. There is a tendency in academic circles to go for very thin film electrodes on quite thick supports. That's never practical for a device. You're going to end up with some very attractive numbers to academics if you scale everything to the active material, but the actual total amount of support and active material needs to be taken into account. So let's carry on. What do we got here? The supercapacitor stores energy by separation of charge two ways. One is the double layer. This is the dominant mechanism for a purely carbon electrode, but if you have an oxide electrode, it's going to be there as well. This is the double layer where the cation C plus is just at the surface. If we go to the Faradaic pseudocapacitance, make use of some of the internals of the oxide nanostructure that you've got, then you have redox processes and you get cations going into the oxide. If this was manganese dioxide, then you're going from manganese 4 on the left to manganese 3 on the right. So you get both, of course. No system has no surface. Everything has a surface. So an oxide system is both a double layer and a pseudocapacitative system. And they do behave remarkably at first sight like standard capacitors. This is just a charge-discharge sawtooth profile. MO45 at the bottom just tells you that we've actually grown these nano-grape materials that we've used here through a membrane with 0.45 micron pores in it. So here are measured capacitative responses as a function of cycling. This goes on horizontally to thousands of cycles. On the page, you have a couple of hundred cycles, but that's 200 farads per gram of active material in a thick electrode system. And I point out that one reason for going for metal oxides is that a gram is not much metal oxide. If you have a hybrid electrode system, here you'll have a very small flag of manganese dioxide and a very large flag of what we use as the counter electrode, which is just Darko G60, cheap as chips carbon. Not expensive at all. On a Ragone plot, things begin to look a bit more mysterious. And also, in this plot, we've included temperature. So the bottom, the yellow is at near ambient temperature, the blue at the top is at 80 Celsius. And you may say, why is 80 Celsius relevant? Don't put your supercapacitor anywhere near the engine compartment of your internal combustion engine car. Those sorts of temperatures are accessed there. It's in plots like this that some of the oddities of supercapacitors appear. At the international meeting in Poznan in June, it was argued that supercapacitors aren't capacitors at all because they don't behave as classical capacitors. They don't follow some of the behaviours. It looks nice in that graph in that as the temperature goes up, your accessible specific capacitances go up. But there are certain problems. This graph here shows the effects storing a system for a number of days. What is the effect on storing for a given number of days at a particular temperature on the behavior of a system? And the one that's near room temperature, the left-hand scale, I should explain, is relative to the initial capacitance of the cell at that temperature. The one which is at near room temperature, the black one, a capacitance is retained, but the higher and higher you go, the less that capacitance is retained. This does have implications for what you can do with this sort of supercapacitor in terms of storage. You don't store it out on the runway in Riyadh because it'll be dead. Let's carry on again. Right. So people have suggested that in terms of a pseudo-capacitative system, carbon manganese dioxide supercapacitors may be attractive. Well, I'd agree with that. And indeed, there's a lot of fine control on the materials. You can access, depending on how you make the measurements, very high specific capacitances, and that's 700 farads per gram at 80 Celsius, but you will get a massive loss of cycle life and also a loss of shelf life if you store well away from what would be ambient temperature in Southern California in the winter. So I'll stop there.
Time for questions, if anybody would like to ask. Anthony?
If I can kick off. First of all, apologies to Ted, because I won't ask him a question, but could we go back to Bob, please, and just have a 30-second recap of what he would have said about redox batteries, please?
Sure.
I'll carry on and go on to a couple of slides. Can I have my slides back up, please? Right. What we're doing we have the ability to vary the membrane quite reproducibly and tunably. The reason that we have this ability, it arises out of our work on alkaline membrane fuel cells. We adopted a strategy of membrane formation, which involves starting with an engineering insulating hydrofluorocarbon polymer, which is preformed into a film, so we don't have any film-forming steps. Much of the research in polymer electrolyte membranes for fuel cells is people solvent-casting into something like a Petri dish. You have problems then of homogeneity, you have problems of pinholes. That sort of membrane is not really transferable direct into a redox flow battery environment at all. It's just not going to stand up to it. Our membranes are 20 to 120 or even 200 microns thick. The basis of the process is to take your engineering polymer and electron beam irradiate it and then store at low temperature. Electron beam irradiation may sound quite recherché, quite fancy. It isn't. In the UK, a very large proportion of the plastics used in the health industry are sterilized using electron beam irradiation. These are commercial facilities. So we take an insulating polymer, an A4 sheet, a stack of those, say 20 stacked, take them to an electron beam irradiation facility. That then introduces reactive centers that we can effectively protect by taking them down to low temperature. We then react with a monomer to form interpenetrating polymers, which we can functionalize. We can make them acidic. We can make them alkaline. We can vary the head group. There's a lot of chemical variability there. And so what we're doing, if we go all the way through the other slides, the compulsory one, this is our test cell system with a US dollar bill showing you the scale. You might recognize the design. It's a scaled-down version of what was Plurion, what's used at Strathclyde, the cell that we're using, and we're actually going to be modeling and using with these cells an all vanadium system with a variable polymer membrane separator, and we're using carbon felt electrodes from a UK manufacturer. Thank you.
Any other questions? Yes.
Tony Vassala from University of Sydney. A question to Ted. I think you had it on the slide, but I didn't see it. Roughly what fraction of the battery cost is due to the separator? Because I think you were saying you were using the iron selective separators.
It wasn't on the slide, and I think... Sorry? Oh, Richard's going to answer for me.
Ah, right. For the Regenesis system, I'm not sure of the exact cost, but for other systems, it can come out to 1% to 2% of the capital costs, I believe.
Thank you.
Other questions? One over here.
What is the effect of purity on your lead flow system? Do you use 99 or how many nines purity, and does that have a difference on your lifetime?
For the source of lead, it's not that sensitive. If you have a high proportion of impurities, then yes. But some of the work we did was looking at putting in other metal elements to see what effect they have, particularly on the lead dioxide from improving conductivity. So the starting material we used for the lead was 99% pure. So in terms of analytical sciences, not very pure. But in terms of process chemistry, I'd probably fairly reasonably pure.
As a fellow Brit, I was curious to see a panel of assembled British scientists working in electrochemistry, because as a journalist covering this field, I never get to hear anything about you, which says something about EPSRC press office activity. But let's pass that to one side. It's essentially an academic panel, That's okay. Where is the British A123 systems? Where is the British Maxwell? Where is the equivalent in any of those fields to actually bring any of the innovation that you're working on to fruition? Because I think that's rather sad that it appears to be working without any real industrial support. And if I might say so, chicken feed funding.
If you go to the EPSRC website, you can download the SuperGen brochure. Associated with every SuperGen consortium is a group of industrialists. In some, they put industrial money in. In this area, they don't. They are observers and supporters in kind. In the areas that we're talking about here, then we have people like CTEC in the battery area, Nexion, Oxis. There are a number of industries in the UK. I do think you're underselling the national effort, although Anthony was certainly right that we're not abundantly funded. If you just Google SuperGen, you'll probably find the brochure, which is easily downloadable.
Does anybody else want to comment on the question?
Can I also comment that later this, within the next two or three weeks, we have a deadline in the UK for what's called the Energy Storage Grand Challenge, and the Energy Storage Grand Challenge will be universities and industry working together under EPSRC auspices. Watch this space.
I suppose the only thing to add to that is there's FP7 funding, which relies on industry and academic collaboration. But yeah, the underlying factor is that there isn't as much, or there doesn't seem to be as much funding from industry in the UK as there are in other parts of the world, particularly the US and China.
Time for perhaps one more question. Yes, sir.
Yeah, Paul Denholm, National Renewable Energy Lab. So I was interested to hear your work on the Regenesis technology. So I'm not sure exactly how to ask this question, so I'll just go ahead. Reading between the lines from the press releases after the cancellation of the TVA project and the Little Bartford project, I got the impression that the technology wasn't really considered viable. Can you kind of expand on your thoughts on the viability of the technology?
Tough question, because speaking as an academic, it's hard for me to comment. But if you're asking why did it fail, I think that's the first question everybody always asks. My view is that it was more of a business strategic decision than something fundamentally wrong with the technology. In terms of whether it was viable, well, it was. They were selling plants, so you know, in principle, it was viable. There were some problems, I think, with taking a technology, a new technology, and building the first commercial plant at very large scale. So there was very, you know, it wasn't a case of taking a new technology and building some small, you know, finding some small scale applications and then taking it up the scales. They were going for very large scale applications straight off. And there were all kinds of technical problems in delivering that and delivering it to the people who were paying the bills and convincing them that they were going to meet all the targets and missing a few along the way. But as I say, tough question to answer. I don't know if Richard might have a comment on that.
Not really much to add other than on the face of it, I know that some of the larger stacks that they were using to build up the full system had operated successfully on small-scale trials. So the chemistry had challenges, but I wouldn't say there were any bigger challenges than flow batteries that are being commercialised at the moment. And as Ted said, it's partly a problem of going straight from the lab scale to the full-size multi-megawatt working plant in one chunk.
And that's our time for today. Thank you very much for attending the third session here. And feel free to meet our panelists later on to ask them any further questions.